Chapter 1. Imagination and Learning. Because imagination is difficult to get any firm grasp on, there has been little educational research which focuses on it. Most educational research has difficulty enough dealing with things like knowledge, learning, or development. These are things our methods of research seem able to get some kind of hold on. So we have a great deal of research on the more easily grasped stuff, and very little on imagination. Unfortunately, what we focus on tends to take a disproportionate space in our field of vision. If you were to try to draw from memory a proportionate picture of the moon, you would likely find, on comparing it with reality, that you had drawn your moon much too big. It is, after all, what we usually focus on in our casual looks up at the night sky. Similarly, what we study within the broad realm of education tends to be disproportionately influential on our thinking about educational practice. Everyone acknowledges the importance of imagination in education, but we do not have large and energetic programs of research focused on imagination, which are constantly feeding their findings and implications into educational practice. We do see such influences on practice from educational psychology, philosophy, sociology, and so on, in all of which imagination is largely ignored. Each individual teacher and curriculum designer tends not to be excessively influenced by particular research studies or theories, of course. We compose our views gradually and eclectically from a wide range of theories and research findings in light of our own experiences. From these, we tend to form what I may perhaps call ad hoc principles, which guide our teaching or curriculum choices. If research and theories contribute to these ad hoc principles, and this research and these theories tend to ignore imagination, we may expect to find these principles seriously deficient. My purpose in this chapter is to argue that some of the most influential principles presently in vogue about teaching and curricula tend to suppress children's imagination and undermine some of its potential educational uses. Let me take a few such ad hoc principles. I choose this set because they are enormously influential, and I am sure every teacher has heard them in one form or another, and also because I suspect most teachers and other educators accept them as providing useful guidance. Educational development proceeds, these principles inform us, from the concrete to the abstract, from the simple to the complex, from the known to the unknown, from active manipulation to symbolic conceptualization. These ad hoc principles are not, of course, usually taken as universally true. Language learning is a complex, abstract task, mastered very early. Certain simple insights come only after long study. But I think it is fair to say that these ad hoc principles have a pervasive and profound influence on teaching practice and on curriculum design. Most teachers of young children learn in their professional preparation that children's active manipulation of concrete objects should precede abstract or symbolic learning. It is a commonplace of such programs that in planning teaching we should begin with familiar knowledge and experiences and expand gradually towards new material. These principles are also powerfully influential in shaping the elementary school curriculum. They are most clearly evident in social studies. We begin with the child and present concrete experiences, then focus on the family, then on to communities, working gradually outwards to the broader society and cultural realms of the world. A metaphor for this process, influential in the early formulation of the social studies curriculum, was the concentric circles of the spider's web, along with the rays of which the child could expand to increasingly distant circles from the home starting point. And what role does imagination play in shaping these ad hoc principles? Well, what is imagination? According to Standard Dictionary definition, it is, quote, the act or power of forming mental images of what is not actually present, end quote. Or, quote, the act or power of creating mental images of what has never been actually experienced, end quote. Imagination seems to have had no influence at all on the ad hoc principles. The sense of the child as an energetic creator of mental images of what may never have been experienced seems, on the face of it at least, to conflict with the sense of the child presented in the ad hoc principles that have been so influential in education. Is the child who manipulates concrete materials derived from everyday experiences the same child whose mind is brimming with star warriors, monsters, and wicked witches? And is it more or less important for future educational development that a child be able to create and mentally manipulate these imaginary creatures than that the child be able to conserve liquid volume? I will look at some of these ad hoc principles, then, in the light of some kinds of intellectual activity in which we can see imagination energetically at work. I will begin by considering how just a few features of young children's fantasy might influence or challenge these principles. From the concrete to the abstract, I have suggested that there is an apparent conflict between the images of the child that emerge from the ad hoc principles on the one hand and from our common observations of children's imaginativeness on the other. Let us consider whether this conflict isn't more than merely apparent. If we accept the principle that children's learning progresses from the concrete to the abstract, for example, how do we deal with fantasy stories? In education, this ad hoc principle is used quite widely to support both the claim that we should begin teaching with concrete material things and move from these towards abstract concepts, and also that in learning any subject, we should work from particulars within the experience of the child in the direction of greater abstraction. We commonly hear confidently asserted such claims as children learn best from concrete, hands-on experiences. We need to ask whether children learn everything best from such experiences. Can they learn only from such experiences? Are there things that cannot be learned from such experiences? Are there things that are best learned from other kinds of experiences? And so on. If we take a story such as Cinderella, which seems to cause few comprehension problems for the average 5-year-old, or those jolly narratives in which Mr. Worm and Mrs. Butterfly chat casually about the weather as they go about their various middle-class tasks of shopping or gardening, it is clear that such stories are structured on the relationship of various underlying concepts. In the case of Cinderella, we can immediately see conflicts of fear-hope, kindness, cruelty, and of course, good-bad. These are enormously general, abstract concepts. There is an obvious sense in which children must have these abstract concepts for the concrete story of Cinderella to make sense. That is, the abstraction is prior and prerequisite to being able to understand the concrete story. An immediate objection to this conclusion is that the abstract concepts, fear, hope, good, bad, have been generated from earlier concrete experiences. I will return to this below. Another apparent counterexample to the ad hoc principle will be evident to anyone who has read a book like The Lord of the Rings to a child. The parts of the narrative that are most comprehensible and engaging are those whose meaning turns on the child's understanding of abstract concepts like loyalty, betrayal, courage, cowardice, honor, selfishness. Without such concepts, much of the concrete action in the book is meaningless. Such concepts are not generated by the actions. The abstract concepts have to be already understood for the actions to make sense. Those parts of the narrative that are least engaging and comprehensive are indeed concrete descriptions of landscape, weather, flora, and so on. Now, obviously, we can provide explanations of such observations. Their point here is only that they seem to conflict with the principle that children's understanding proceeds from the concrete to the abstract. It has been argued that we do not, cannot, infer grammar from the scattered examples of speech that we hear. Similarly, and perhaps more obviously, we do not infer plot forms from hearing a few particular concrete stories. Stories make sense as stories only if we already have some abstract notion of plot to organize and make meaningful the effective force of the story. Very young children, for example, know that the satisfaction of certain expectations set up in the beginning signals the end of the story. The abstract underlying plot rhythm of expectation and satisfaction, then, precedes and is prerequisite to stories being meaningful. Here, then, are three examples which, superficially at least, seem to conflict with the ad hoc principle that we proceed from the concrete to the abstract. Nor are they trivial or arcane matters. Indeed, the centrality of these abstract organizing tools that young children deploy so readily, making sense of all kinds of things that make us wonder whether the ad hoc principle hasn't got matters entirely the wrong way round, and that children's educational development should proceed from the abstract to the concrete. Well, we would obviously be unwise to try to swing to the opposite extreme. The plausibility of the ad hoc principle depends on its being able to reflect something about how we learn various kinds of skills. We come to understand chess by learning the particular concrete moves of each piece, and then putting these together till we achieve an abstract understanding of the rules that govern the game. Though even here, of course, one might want to say that some general notion of the intent of the game has to precede making sense of the individual pieces' moves. Also, in mastering the language, and this is perhaps the most persuasive support for the principle, more concrete terms precede abstract terms. Children seem to use more concrete terms more readily and easily, and often have difficulty with abstract terms. From such support, the ad hoc principle may move to counterattack against my observations from children's fantasy stories. It might be argued that our ability to understand Cinderella or The Lord of the Rings comes from prior concrete experience having generated the abstract concepts required for comprehension of the story. An even grasp of plot forms comes from prior concrete experiences, such as the rhythm of expectation and satisfaction that the baby knows in getting hungry and being fed. Now, it will perhaps be obvious that this argument can merrily chug along for some time. The problems with where it is chugging us to are at least twofold. First, it is moving us increasingly far away from the ad hoc principle, is understood and put into practice in education. In education, it is used to support, for example, beginning mathematics teaching with blocks or fruit pips, and with organizing the social studies curriculum so that families and neighborhoods precede history. And second, it is taking us into one of the most complex and contentious of philosophical questions, one that has been intensely debated from the time of the ancient Greeks, that particulars and abstractions seem to presuppose each other. I will not resolve this philosophical question here or anywhere, but I can think of no way of avoiding it. To challenge the ad hoc principle, then, requires that I at least indicate that its counterattack against my earlier examples is itself not immune from attack. The counterattack is that all abstractions that we see young children using are themselves the product of prior concrete experiences. Before my counterattack, I should perhaps stress that as far as educational uses of the principle are concerned, the earlier observations carry some weight. The principle has been used gradually to leach out of the curriculum and teaching practice a reliance upon or use of abstract concepts. The irrefutable point made by the examples of children's fantasy is that even though young children might not articulate abstract terms and have difficulty with certain kinds of abstract concepts, it is not true that abstract concepts in general are difficult for young children. Indeed, we see children constantly use, flexibly and easily, the most abstract concepts, such as good and bad. So while the ad hoc principle is supported by certain learning processes in young children, it is not valid for all kinds of things that young children can do. It is, in its usual educational interpretation, appropriate only in some respects some of the time. And when taken as generally valid, that is the beginnings of serious imbalance and educational problems. A medieval equivalent of Cole's notes summed up Aristotle's view of how we acquire knowledge as, "There is nothing in the mind except what has passed through the senses." In this view, knowledge, however abstract, is achieved only from concrete particulars. In a more modern formulation, we find it encapsulated in William James's plausible, indeed imaginative, picture of the baby experiencing a blooming, buzzing confusion, out of which and from the particulars of which we gradually induce abstract concepts. The conflicting anti-empiricist or neo-rationalist view is that we arrive in the world with minds structured in particular ways and predisposed to recognize certain patterns and make sense of the world and experience in certain ways. The baby, in this view, experiences a structured world in which certain particulars gradually become distinct as they can be fitted to the mental structures that we are born with. Knowledge is thus composed not merely by experience, but the mind constructively makes its own contribution. In this view, all our knowledge and all our actions are governed by abstract rules, which we have and use even though we are not necessarily conscious of them. The philosophical and psychological support for this view is considerable, and becoming dominant, it seems fair to say. But my point here is not to amass the arguments in favor of it, so much as to indicate that the counterattack made by the ad hoc principle is hardly itself unassailable. I am not trying to establish the primacy of the abstract in children's learning. For such an argument, see Hayek, but only trying to counter the claim for the primacy of the concrete. What can most sensibly be concluded about human learning at present is that the phenomena are vastly more complex than any of our psychological models or the ad hoc principles educators derive from them. We can also sensibly question the adequacy of the ad hoc principle for the educational uses it is made to serve, and consequently question the educational adequacy of those practices and curricula based on the principle. Influenced by this principle, the experience of young children in elementary school classrooms is predominantly involved with the simple and the concrete. There is an avoidance of abstraction because the ad hoc principle has persuaded teachers and curriculum developers that abstract concepts are beyond the comprehension of young children. At the simplest level, we may say that there is a confusion between children's ability to articulate abstractions and their ability to use them. It may be that typical 5-year-olds could not adequately define loyalty or courage, but they use such concepts clearly in making sense of all kinds of stories. There is a sense in which we might say that children understand such concepts so profoundly that they understand with them. They use them to make sense of new knowledge. I think it is fair to conclude that seeing the process of education as a development from the concrete to the abstract is a result of focusing on certain limited logical intellectual activities. But if we make vivid imaginative intellectual activity the focus of our attention, the general adequacy of the ad hoc principle is brought into question. It is at best a partial truth, but also a partial falsehood. As such, we would likely be better off abandoning it and looking for a more adequate ad hoc principle. Of course, children have difficulty learning some things, but we should give up accepting as an adequate explanation of those difficulties that there is inherent in children's intellectual development a progression from the concrete, the abstract. From the known to the unknown. What about the related ad hoc principle about moving from the known to the unknown? If this is true, how can we explain children's easy engagement with star warriors, wicked witches, and talking middle-class worms? We are not here looking for a psychological or psychoanalytic explanation. We could line up the competing arguments about why such creatures are so prominent in young children's mental lives, but these explanations do not help us with the educational claim that children's learning progresses gradually outward from present, local experience to the unknown. This ad hoc principle, again, is not some trivial or arcane matter in education. It is enormously influential. Along with the previous principle, it offers about the only organizing element to the curriculum jumble called social studies, and it is prominently invoked in designing lessons and units of study at all levels of schooling. By considering the content of young children's fantasy stories and their own imaginative games, we are surely forced to wonder about the general adequacy of a principle that claims that our knowledge of the world and experience accumulates gradually from the known to the unknown. Are wicked witches and talking middle-class worms so prominent a part of the known world of children? Well, in one sense, of course, we must say yes. Such figures are all around them in books and on TV, but this only moves the problem to a different context. Why are such fantastic creatures so engaging to young children? It is not enough to conclude simply that such creatures are foisted on children by grown-ups. They fill the world's myth stories and haunt our dreams. They represent something about the vivid, imaginative creativity of the human mind. If we view children's education in terms of the progressive mastery of practical tasks and logical sequences of the discipline areas, then we can reasonably invoke the known to unknown principle. It will guide us to begin with children's present experiences and move gradually outward along lines of content associations. This principle indeed does shape our curricula, and we are no doubt all familiar with charts that gradually plod outward in such logical sequences from what is assumed to be the contents of children's experience. Whatever the organizing value of this principle, we surely recognize, without having to analyze children's fantasy, that it inadequately describes our own educational development. Consider how you learned whatever you consider most valuable. We pick it up bits and pieces, and suddenly see connections. These break or diffract, and are recomposed in new ways with disparate pieces. If we consider briefly children's fantasy stories, and recall the objections to the previous principle, we can surely recognize that we directly make sense of all kinds of new knowledge by fitting it to our abstract schemes. Frodo's journey to Mordor makes sense even before we consider the story's affective power, because we can fit all the new elements and events to our abstract categories of good-bad, courage-cowardice, honor-greed, and so on. That is, we see in such simple cases that we can readily understand all kinds of new material by a principle that does not at all require us to move outward along lines of content associations, connecting new knowledge to that which the child already has. We can introduce any knowledge as long as we ensure that it fits the abstract conceptual structures the child has in place. History, then, need not remain untouched in the primary school, its absence at present being justified on the grounds that children lack the abstract concepts that are necessary to make history meaningful, chronological time, causality, and so on. From observing how children make sense of fantasy stories, we can see that they do have available conceptual tools that can make history meaningful. They may lack a logical conception of causality, but they clearly have available the sense of causality that holds stories together and moves them along. The conceptual tools that can make sense of Cinderella and Lord of the Rings can be used to make sense of the Athenians' struggle for freedom against the tyrannous Persian Empire, or the monks' struggle to preserve civilized learning against the ravages of the Vikings. Nor need such understanding of history be trivial. Young children have the conceptual tools to learn the most profound things about our past, as a struggle for freedom against arbitrary violence, for security against fear, for knowledge against ignorance, and so on. They do not learn those concepts. They already have them when they arrive at school. They use those concepts to learn about the world and experience. Now, we might want to engage in all kinds of arguments about the educational value of such history at the beginning of children's schooling. The only point I am making here is that the known-to-unknown principle is an inadequate guide to what children can learn. If we consider a little further how we progressively apply our abstract organizing categories to making fuller sense of experience, we might even further reject the known-to-unknown principle. One common procedure we see at work in children's learning is the dialectical process of forming binary opposites and mediating between them. For example, in learning the temperature continuum, children tend first to learn the binary opposite concepts of hot and cold. Next, they mediate between these and learn the concept warm. This is elaborated by then mediating between, say, warm and cold, and the concept of cool or fairly cold is established. Some people claim this is a fundamental structure of all human learning. We need accept this no more than we need accept the known to unknown principle. What we can commonly observe, however, are examples of this binary opposite formation and mediation at work. Also, it is a model that conflicts with the ad hoc principle that determines so much educational practice. Just in passing, and ignoring my earlier claim that we would be unconcerned with explanations, we might consider the pervasiveness of this binary opposites and mediation process. It seems to be one of the mind's commoner procedures for trying to make sense of the world and experience. It suggests interesting explanations for much of the fantastic content of children's thinking. If you look at the world through the eyes of the child, and you use the reliable dialectical process that is helping to make sense of much of what you see, then you will note what seems like an empirically sound binary distinction between nature and culture. If you were a child, you will not likely put it in these terms, of course, but you will notice that how much ever you talk to the cat, it won't talk back, and however much you encourage them, the guinea pig and the gerbil will not make clothes for themselves nor tables and chairs for their cage. If you try to use the mediating process that has done you so well in being able to make sense and talk about continua of temperature and speed, size, and much else, you will search for categories that mediate between nature and culture. If you cannot find them, that mental process will create them. So you will generate things like talking middle-class worms. Such a creature is a mediation between nature and culture, as warm is a mediation between hot and cold. Similarly, you will observe a binary distinction between life and death. You will mediate and create ghosts, spirits, and all kinds of beings which are both alive and dead, as warm is hot and cold, and middle-class worms are natural and cultural. My point here is only that this particular process of learning seems to be derived from the way the mind is programmed to learn, and proceeds even in the face of empirical reality, generating mediations which require imaginative creation. The logical plotting known to unknown principle does not account for this most powerful tool. Now, it might be argued that the known to unknown principle does account for this and any other counterexamples. It might be claimed that in the case of the abstract categories, which allow us to make sense of any new content organized on them, that the abstract categories are the known, and we use them to make sense of the unknown content. And in the previous example, it may be claimed that the binary opposites are the known, and we mediate from them to an unknown. Certainly, this interpretation saves the principle. And the value of the principle may be reinterpreted as pointing up that we need to be sure that new content can be structured on known abstract categories, or that it be a mediation between known binary opposites. Its purpose remains to remind us that there needs to be some coherence in the sequencing of children's learning. We can save the principle this way, but two points need to be made. First, it is saved by widening its interpretation to the point of making it a rather vacuous truism. Second, its interpretation so far has been used to support a curriculum and teaching practices based on expanding content associations. By focusing briefly on children's imaginative activities, we see that learning can expand a number of different ways, and that some of them seem much more pervasive and powerful than that captured in the known to unknown principle. The principle has been an instrument of highlighting one process of learning at the expense of others, especially at the expense of those associated with the use of imagination. Of course, there are senses in which the ad hoc principle represents some truth, but it has falsified more than it has clarified. Its acceptance as generally true is to see the whole night sky filled with the moon. Conclusion. The remaining principles I mentioned above, from the simple to the complex, from active manipulation to symbolic conceptualization, are clearly related to the two I have discussed. Given more space, those two could be discussed in detail, and we could also consider the history of these principles. They are all principles that have emerged from viewing the child as a prosaic thinker with not well-developed capacities for dealing with certain logical and technical tasks. They are principles that can survive only by ignoring the highly developed imaginative capacities of children and the immensely energetic forms of learning that they clearly use constantly, and which can be seen more readily if we focus on imaginative activities. Teaching practices and curricula that are derived from research which views the child's imagination as largely irrelevant to learning are not calculated either to use or to develop the imaginative capacities of children. My point is not that we should increase the fantasy content of school curricula. Others adequately make the case for the use of the arts in general as stimulants of these capacities. My point is that we need, for the educational benefit of children, to reconstruct our curricula and teaching methods in light of a richer image of the child as an imaginative as well as logical-mathematical thinker. What we call imagination is also a tool of learning, in the early years perhaps the most energetic and powerful one. The influence of the ad hoc principles I have been discussing has been to produce a curriculum and teaching methods that have excluded much of the richness of human experience to which young children can have direct access. They do this because such rich intellectual experience cannot be fitted to their arid and impoverished image of the child. What cannot be made concretely manipulable and directly tied to some simple content within the child's immediate experience has been increasingly forced out of the early school curriculum. We are treating young children as fools. Our early childhood curricula and practices are largely filled with trivia, except where the imaginative work of individual teachers counters the influence of these principles. The most powerful and energetic intellectual tools children bring to school are largely ignored and excluded when research is conducted on children's learning, intelligence, development, and so on. The products of that research then seep into education and support the kinds of ad hoc principles considered above, and these have been powerfully, if subtly influential, in shaping curricula and informing teachers' preconceptions about what and how children best learn. Perhaps ironically, my conclusion from a focus on children's fantasy is that a more academically rich curriculum is appropriate in the early years. Children's imaginative capacities, let me stress, do not only find an outlet in fantasy stories. They find their real work and growth in being applied to history, mathematics, and the sciences as well. An impoverished empiricist view of science has misused the authority of science to promote in education a narrow kind of logical thinking at the expense of those forms of thinking which we see most clearly in children's imaginative activities. The prevalence of this view has served to push imagination to the educational sidelines, to the frills of art, music, and so on, from which it can less easily be displaced. As this essentially 19th-century view of science finally recedes, and a more balanced view of science as a human activity becomes dominant, we in education might sensibly try to establish a more balanced view of children's thinking and learning. The ad hoc principles I have discussed are the remnants of the old, unbalanced view. My purpose in this chapter has been to argue that imagination is a powerful and neglected tool of learning, and that we need to rethink our teaching practices and curricula with a more balanced appreciation of children's intellectual capacities. Prominent among those intellectual capacities is imagination. By ridding ourselves of the influential and restrictive ad hoc principles, we can see our way to enormously enriching the elementary school. We can provide children with things to think about that challenge and stimulate the imaginative powers they have to think with.